How to do, buckaroos. Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations Podcast. It is Monday, January 27th. This is 2020. I'm not going to get tired of that, so I apologize in advance for the other 11 months of the year where I'm still going to drop that in. I'm your host, Kelly Gamont. With me today, I have two fantastic panelists. They like to call themselves the Dream Team. They are Charlotte Henry. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello, hello. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Monday.
Yeah, I get it. Also with me today, I have John Martellaro. Hi, John.
I am here. I have spoken.
Oh, it's going to be one of those shows.
I think it is. John has just rolled up on his blurg and is here to give us some knowledge. And actually, John, I kind of want to start with you because we had this revamp last week of Apple's Work at Apple page, or the jobs page on their website. I know, like, Charlotte had mentioned that the video was pretty great, that there's a video on the site now. There didn't used to be. It sort of used to be a standard issue jobs page. And I know that Apple does have a fair number of standard issue jobs, but they also have some stuff that's pretty interesting and cool. And John, having put in time there, what was it like to get a job when you got a job there?
Well, when I was first thinking about getting a job at Apple, I was about the business of getting connected. I was going to WWDC every year. I had been to WWDC maybe 8 or 9 years in a row before I got hired. Mm-hmm. I was kind of plugged into some circles. I was having dinner with a certain science and Unix team the night before WWDC keynote. We'd get together at El Fornaio or somewhere in Cupertino, and we'd have dinner. And so I kind of feel like this page is great, and it sort of has a happy-go-lucky look to it. But my advice is that if you want to work for Apple, don't just go to the page and smile and submit your resume. I think it takes a little bit more work than that. I think it takes being involved somehow, either being known as a writer, like some people. Mm-hmm. Who got hired on the editorial team, or a noted developer who's done some spectacular work and Apple wants to bring you in-house because of your expertise, or like Michael Gartenberg working for a company that interfaces with Apple, and Apple team members get to know you. Mm-hmm. and they personally put in a recommendation for you. I don't know if it's true today, but I suspect that it's exceptionally helpful to not only make Apple aware of your abilities and submit your resume and talk to them, but also to have kind of been involved in the community and been involved with Apple in a peripheral way. And they kind of got a feel for who you are and what your skills are. And my mother wrote me one time and said, my son wants to work for Apple. What should I do? And I told her, have him become an expert in some software area, like the world's foremost expert on Python. Mm-hmm. Libraries or PHP on the Mac or something like that, because then Apple has a case for acquiring your talents,
right?
And that's probably a better way to go than just simply going to the website with a resume and hoping for the best.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would imagine that now they get significantly more resumes than they used to, so there's also that piece of being able to stand out if you're trying to get a job at Apple, I would imagine.
So yeah, and if you have somebody internal to Apple who knows who you are and can speak to you, that's a real booster. I mean, that is gold.
Absolutely. Nepotism.
No, not
hooray
nepotism.
For nepotism.
No. It's just an Apple employee knows who you are, has seen you in action, seen your work, read your articles, seen your software, is aware of some contribution you made to GitHub and said, this is a person who I'm familiar with and I'm comfortable with and I know what they can do.
Right. It's less about
fudge resumes.
Getting the job because you're somebody's kid or nephew or whatever. And it's more about just knowing someone on the inside, which is how a lot of people get jobs anyway.
Yeah.
This is just sort of leveled up a little bit,
Probably the easiest way to do that is to hope you get a selection to go to WWDC.
Mm-hmm.
And attend the sessions, go up on stage, start developing a relationship with some team that intrigues you.
Mm-hmm.
Get the guy's business card. You know, after the, I don't know how it happens these days because I haven't been to WWDC in a while. But typically, after a session is over, there'll be some gathering. There'll be some people surrounding the speakers on the stage and asking them questions for about 10 or 15 minutes. And if you can get the business card of one of those Apple team members.
Mm-hmm.
And start opening up a dialogue with them and make them aware of what you're doing. That is a great way to go. And it doesn't guarantee you a job, but I think it's a better than just being a stranger sitting aloof at the job.
So scene. I'm going to jump in here because I slightly have an issue with what John's saying.
Okay.
And I suspect my issue is part of the reason behind Apple's new jobs page. If we want to look philosophically, the jobs page now is relatively easy to find.
Mm-hmm.
It's very appealing. It's very open. It's not saying apply for XY job. It's asking people who have skills to let Apple know about their skills. And what I think is good about that is it's actually taking away the need to spend all the money to get to WWDC, give someone your card and hope you can get in. I think it actually encourages a wider variety of ideas, a wider variety of people to have a page like this where Apple is saying, come and tell us how great you are.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lovely video that's kind of quite, you know, I don't want to oversell it, but it's kind of, you know, uplifting and it makes you think, yeah, great. This is a company that I can be part of. I actually think it's very, very Tim Cook, this whole thing, as silly as that might sound. It's not about a kind of old boys network of who drinks together at certain conferences or who sends messages to each other on GitHub, although I totally appreciate and agree with John that human networking is vital. It is in any industry. But I think what this kind of outreach via this page is doing is saying, look, we're a company that has lots of different things. We need lots of different people. Come tell us why you're great. And Tim Cook has talked a lot about diversity and how that benefits companies. And I think this kind of page is a, not to oversell it, but I think it's kind of the front page of that philosophy in a way.
I think you're right, Charlotte. I mean, it's a good thing to present yourself as a desirable company to work for. You don't want to be obscure. You don't want to seem to be a sort of secretive, a special club that it's hard to get a job at Apple. That you want to make it look like you're open to all sorts of different people and that you're enthusiastic about people. And there's a lot of competition in Silicon Valley. And so you want to make sure that, you know, you're a high profile company for the desirable kind of, you know, talented people that are out there.
So I think
an important part of it.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And also for people who are actually desirable, but might not think they are to you. So
sure.
People who think, oh, I could never get a job at Apple.
Right.
And whereas actually Apple may actually see some of the work they submit through this website and think, actually, this person has something to offer us.
Yeah. I like that too.
And I think making that portal as accessible and enticing and friendly as possible actually is quite a good thing. Like I say, I don't want to oversell a website redesign, but I think if it's coming from the place where I think it is, which mm-hmm. is personified by Tim Cook, I think that's
a very
good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good approach. I think that's exactly what they're trying to do, Charlotte. I'm just saying that if you expect to, you know, smile and go to the website and submit your resume and then they'll say, hey, this is cool, and then come on in for an interview, I would submit that it's a little bit more complicated once you get started.
Oh, yeah. The game goes on a lot longer than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is a good way to get in front of Apple people if you have the opportunity. One thing that I noticed, not necessarily, I mean, yes, Apple people, but also just sort of, you know, trying to relate to other folks in general, was the opportunities to share. So like Charlotte's talking about doing something exceptional on GitHub, even if you never make it to Cupertino for anything, you still have an opportunity to be someone who does something interesting and maybe eventually goes to work for Apple, because that stuff is out there for everyone to look at. So a lot of those opportunities sort of give people the opportunity to, a lot of those platforms help sort of help you publicize the stuff that you're doing, and you don't have to like go to Apple and make a presentation or anything like that. That stuff's all available, and it makes it easier because the incidental stuff that you work on too is also out there. Like if you have a reasonably updated Twitter feed or Facebook feed or GitHub activity that shows up regularly, like I don't have to sit down with you and spend half an hour catching up on what you've been up to for the last year since I saw you last summer at the thing. Like I can know what all of that is and start asking you specific questions about that stuff over time. So I think that's helped as well.
I totally agree with that. But I also think there's another point here, which is that Apple is a very changing company, and it's changing very quickly. And the skills that Apple require are not just, obviously, engineers and those kind of people are always going to be central, absolutely core yeah. to what Apple does. But it's a very changing company. And if you are someone that can help, you know, be a curator on Apple News Plus, if you are someone that can produce the kind of videos that we're regularly posting on the Mac Observer, Apple is producing some really wonderful videos at the moment. Mm-hmm. If that's also having this kind of new portal to submit jobs to, that it, you know, opens up Apple to those kind of people, the people it really, really needs at the moment.
Wow. Yeah, see, that's, and I agree with you, Charlotte, that this is also just more evidence that Apple's continuing to evolve. And I know it's been a long time now, but it's still sort of, I think there are still people who are going to call this the new leadership. And it's really less new leadership than it is just Apple continuing to evolve, which it would have done anyway, even if the last guy were still around. Like, there would still be evolution and change happening, and I think this is a piece of that. I like where it's going, though. And you're absolutely right that they need to hire lots of people who are not necessarily developers or engineers in any particular way. You can be really good at something else and still end up with an opportunity there.
This translates into some good advice for any student. And no matter what company you want to work for, who you have your eyes on, whether it's some aerospace company and you want to be an astronaut, or whether it's Google or Amazon or Apple, it's important to develop a career in such a way that you build up a skill set. It's one thing to go to a class and get a grade and then forget everything you know. It's another thing to build on your infrastructure and start with, you know, for example, algebra, and then move on to trig, and then analytic geometry, and then calculus, and then differential calculus, and to develop a
John,
real
you're giving
strong,
me a panic attack.
To develop a real like, strong skill set.
I don't know where
a
we're
part
going.
Of the education.
It's making me nervous.
So my wife is a professor, and I see students more interested in passing the class and getting a grade than they are in building a skill set that they can present to an employer, no matter who it is. Mm-hmm. So that's my advice.
Yeah, and one thing that I think helps in that is that there are jobs now in certain avenues that are very, very specific. So like I know when I was doing work with App Camp for Girls, one of the field trips we went on, there was a person who was explaining them at a game company that they were just responsible for the lighting in the game. And that's a very specific thing to be in charge of. So if you find something that sounds like it's a very niche kind of a thing, but you really, really like it, go pursue it. It's going to be pretty great. excuse me. So our other topic today, Charlotte, is over to you. As we talk about, we've gotten new information about Jeff Bezos and his iPhone.
Yes.
And here's the thing. Like, my primary takeaway from this is that the thing that we need to keep in mind is that none of this is all newly discovered information, but the event itself is not new, which is why some of it sounds a little weird when we read about it.
That's very much an important part of the story, that it's not new, we're only just learning about it. That's important to remember as we discuss it. So, as lots of you will have heard, Jeff Bezos his phone was hacked. He alleges it was by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, or at least on his orders. It appears there was a WhatsApp message sent from a number associated with the Crown Prince, sent to Jeff Bezos, that put malware on Jeff Bezos's iPhone 10. Mm-hmm. Weird enough as it is. Now, what we don't quite know is what the malware was.
Correct.
We do. What seems likely is that it did not require Jeff Bezos to press anything, to activate anything, to fire this malware. It seems like once it was on the device and it got onto his device via WhatsApp, his device was at that point infected. He didn't have to click a link or anything.
Right. And that message was sent in May of 2018.
Correct.
So we're learning all this new stuff now, but that's why some of this sounds weird. Like, what's Jeff Bezos doing with an iPhone 10 right now? Like, it's not now. That's where this comes out.
Well, we're learning about it now because the forensic analysis of this incident has only just been completed. It was very complicated to work out what happened. I mean, it's at the level where the UN has got involved.
Right.
So yes, you're right. It has taken a long time and it sounds weird, but that is because this incident appears to have been so complicated. It took time to decipher whatever had gone on.
Right. It was, for people who might remember, because I think we talked about it here, Jeff Bezos wrote a post he wrote something on Medium and accused the Inquirer of trying to blackmail him and said it was because his phone had been hacked. And that was February of 2019. So that was sometime after this.
We have to be a little bit careful with that because it's not totally clear if this hack relates to what he talked about, which was private matters,
right?
He alleged he was being blackmailed to do with the separation from his wife.
Yes.
So we need to. I'm not convinced the two. I might be wrong, but I'm not sure the two incidents are the same.
One I'm may not have led either. To the other. I'm not convinced they're related, but that incident in February of 19 was when he started to realize his phone might have been hacked, I think is how this timeline comes together.
Yeah.
So I think that's where this comes from. The other thing in this was all of the data that started immediately
coming out of his phone. That's correct. From a lot of Apple apps that he didn't particularly use. So we're talking things like Mail. Mm-hmm. And there were some other default Apple apps that he hadn't really used, but had kind of seemed to be exporting a lot of data.
29,000% above his normal data usage.
Right.
And I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that Jeff Bezos probably spends a lot of time using his phone.
Yeah, but it was things like Safari and, like I said, Mail that suddenly started pumping out loads of data.
Right.
His device was not connected to iCloud, we don't think.
But wasn't using backup. It wasn't using backup, so yeah, that wasn't any of the data.
No. So what I also want to talk about quickly with this is there seems to have been a bit of confusion because it appears that the incident and the malware was transferred to the Amazon boss's phone via WhatsApp. WhatsApp is obviously owned by Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Sir Nick Clegg, the former British Deputy Prime Minister, now runs global communications and public affairs at Facebook.
Yes.
He appeared on Radio 4's Today program, which I can't think of an American equivalent, but it is basically the agenda setting radio news show of the morning in the UK from the BBC. And he was interviewed and discussed about this incident and tried to actually kind of roll back on WhatsApp's culpability in this. Now, we don't know if WhatsApp was particularly at fault, but he was trying to deny that there was any possibility that Jeff Bezos could have been hacked via WhatsApp. He said, "We're as sure as you can be that the technology of end-to-end encryption cannot be hacked into. He also said, if someone sends you a malicious email, it only comes to life when you open it. And try to compare that issue, which we all know about and have spoken about plenty of times.
Yes.
He tried to compare that to what happened with Jeff Bezos. Now, that is incorrect. It seems pretty clear that the malware that infected Jeff Bezos' phone did not have to be activated by a user or indeed the attacker. And Nick Clegg seems to think just because something is encrypted, it is not vulnerable to malware and attack. I'm now going to hand over to John, who is twitching.
That's a good point.
Who is going to explain.
Oh, no, no, no. She's
just how horrible that is.
She's put me under pressure here. But no, I was thinking while you were talking that end-to-end encryption in progress during transit has nothing to do with the behavior of the app that's residing on the phone and its environment and what's right. going on in its interaction with the operating system and files that have been downloaded. So that was a bit disingenuous, I thought, the comment from the Facebook executive, if that's what really is the case. So
it's totally disingenuous. And this idea that it would require some kind of user activation, that comparing it to an email, that you get spam email you get sent, mm-hmm. I thought was also deeply disingenuous. And we were talking off air about, you know, the possible people that could have conducted such an attack or been used to conduct such an attack. Mm-hmm. Something like the Pegasus software deployed by a group called NSO. They're an Israeli kind of cybersecurity mm-hmm. organization. They apparently have denied any involvement in this attack. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can take a bunch of hackers' words for however strongly you want, but they were pretty explicit. Another company thought to have the capability to conduct such an attack is called the Hacking Team, mm-hmm. based in Milan in Italy. They did not reply when the New York Times asked them directly if they were involved in this. Mm-hmm. Again, you can draw whatever you like from that. I think it's interesting one group replied and one didn't, but obviously I have no evidence either way. You found, Kelly, that actually Pegasus should not really affect an iPhone X.
Not anymore. And that was part of the thing that I brought up right when we started talking about this was the timeline on this, because as I was reading the article and going through and looking at, you know, what they had talked about and the process they went through to find out what happened and all this kind of stuff, it kept sort of striking me as like this, like, it struck me as odd, you know, why does Jeff Bezos has an iPhone 10? Well, because in 2018, that was the only phone there was. You know, that was the top of the line phone. So that kind of stuff is like, that was the parts of this that I kept having a hard time with, because we're reading about it now, like it's new. And, but I absolutely agree that this is disingenuous at best. And, particularly Nick Clegg's comments are, not very well informed at worst. Like, this is the person in charge of delivering messaging to people, and this is the kind of stuff that he's going around saying about security. Like, sounds really concerning to me. The most concerning thing out of this entire article, though, I thought, was reading the phrase private surveillance industry. Because I don't think that's getting enough attention. And I think...
Hey, Ronan Farrow.
I think this is the scariest... One of the scariest things I've read in a long, long time is private surveillance industry. This was the characterization by somebody from the United Nations who co-authored this statement from the United Nations about it and said, this case really highlights the threats that are posed by a lawless and unaccountable private surveillance industry. So I feel like
there's two things to remember here. That this, as you said, Kelly, this was an iPhone 10 in 2018. Mm-hmm. Apple, along with the forensic analysis by the FBI and everybody else concerned, I'm sure Apple is keenly interested in how this happened.
Yeah.
And it's been 2 years, and I'm sure that if Apple has figured out a way to close any of those doors they have in the subsequent mm-hmm. iOS updates,
The Pegasus malware they have, they said it took it took advantage of a number of vulnerabilities, and all of those have been patched.
Right. So this is a good general reminder that you should always have the latest version of iOS on your phone. And it probably isn't a bad idea to not have a phone that's too old in time because of the hardware. May not have up-to-date capabilities.
Yeah, make sure you've got something reasonably recent. Yeah.
I know it's too much to ask to get a phone every year, but probably every year, 2 years and three at the most.
I would say you could easily go 3 years because you're still getting the latest operating system that way, at least from Apple.
Right.
Can I throw something else out there to you two?
Go ahead.
Is it not weird that Jeff Bezos, the world's richest man, did not have a phone that was somewhat better protected? Like, how was there nothing on his phone that, like, could stop whatever, you know, even high-end malware, or flagged up that there was an issue on his device? Mm-hmm. I know that defenders are always kind of running behind what the attackers are doing. I know all of this. Right. But it just seems extraordinary to me that such a high-profile, rich person who, let's remember, also owns a newspaper. Mm-hmm. A newspaper... Okay, we won't get into the Jamal Khashoggi issue, but I think you can work out where I'm going with it. But anyway, he owns a major newspaper and one of the world's biggest companies. Mm-hmm. I find it extraordinary that he could have a device that appears to be so vulnerable.
The thing that I took away from it was... Go ahead, John.
One of the rules in technology is that the farther up you go in the executive chain, the less technically astute the executives are.
Right, but is that true of Jeff Bezos?
Sure,
really?
Yeah.
But I know not every tech exec is Tim Cook, who has a background in programming and engineering. But
right. But at the same time, your phone is pumping out 29,000% the data it normally pumps out, and that didn't raise a flag to anybody. Nobody got a text message about, like, your data's going to slow down. Like, nothing?
I have to say, I find it weird.
That's the part that stuck with me, was the amount of data pouring out of his phone. You know, and like I said, I'm going to go ahead and presume that the head of not one major organization, but two, probably spends a fair amount of time on his phone, and it, you know, not just on phone calls. And if that's the case, then that amount of data should be something that gets noticed by somebody.
Apple,
like, even if he has unlimited data, it's going to say, like, you're going to get throttled, because I know Seattle has data throttling. He doesn't own his own cellular company.
There are strides to be made in iOS in terms of AI when it comes to monitoring the health and activities of the phone.
No, John, it's not up to the phone.
That kind of walks. Well, I mean, a good AI agent in the phone should be kind of supervising and monitoring what's going on. Anything unusual should result in an AI sending an alert to the user saying, hey, look, I noticed this. What do you think of this?
Well, that's what I'm saying. AT&T should have sent him a notice that said, we noticed this.
I don't think that's where it belongs, because AT&T's got too much network management going on to pay attention to individual phones.
Except that he's hogging data. And this is the whole reason that AT&T got in trouble in the first place, was because of the whole, like, we say it's unlimited, but it's not really unlimited, because we're going to slow everything down to, like...
Well, imagine you've got a scientist, he's in Antarctica, and he decides to do a big low upload to the home office.
Uh-huh.
To the university in San Francisco. And so, you know, he's stored the data, and now he gets an uplink.
Uh-huh.
You know, he does a burst of his data back to the graduate students in San Francisco. Uh-huh. And you go, are we supposed to worry about that? You know?
He's not doing it on his iPhone, John.
It happens all the time. Well, it might happen on an iPhone.
I doubt that very much. If you're using an iPhone in Antarctica at a research station, we would love to hear from you.
That's just the kind of thing I'm talking about. I mean, you know, it should be a local AI agent who knows your activities, who's been monitoring what you do.
And my point is
more poised to make a decision about something going wrong.
But that doesn't exist now. And AT&T saying, holy crap, that's a lot of data, is a thing that does exist now, and it should have happened. And that was the footnote in this that I was looking at, going, why didn't anybody anywhere get any sort of alert about, like, this is a whole lot of data? Even unlimited, they still will tell you, like, gosh, that's a lot. You're coming up against a limit, or, you know, something. So usually that's what happens.
Well, Apple wants us to be happy with our phones and to be pleased. And Apple takes the responsibility for doing the security behind the scenes.
Yes.
Sometimes that breaks down.
Well,
I know Apple's resistant to malware detection and other software on the phone. They haven't allowed apps like that to exist.
I know that Apple wants me to be happy with my phone. I also know that AT&T and Verizon and T-Mobile literally could not care less how much I love my phone. They don't. They really, really don't. So that's why I get text messages from them about stuff like that and not from Apple about stuff like that. That's all I'm saying.
Also, that doesn't actually answer the question why someone like Jeff Bezos has a private security team. It doesn't actually answer the question why in this specific case, this specific individual was not protected better.
Yeah, that's true. And well, I bet he is now. There has to be, I would presume there are new measures in place on his phone and everywhere else that would keep that from happening. So we'll have to see. Anyway, as I said, if you are uploading data from the research station in Antarctica, we'd like to hear from you. an email message is very much data. I promise you won't get in trouble with AT&T. If you do, I'll write you a note. If you are anywhere else and would like to give us feedback, you can email us at observations@macobserver.com. You can get us at TMO Daily on Twitter, and you can leave comments in the show notes. I want to thank both of you for being here today. Thank you so much for joining me, Dream Team, being here on a Monday. John Martellaro, thank you.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Charlotte Henry, thank you so much for coming by.
Always a pleasure.
I'm your host, Kelly Gamont. I will talk to all of you tomorrow, as long as my voice holds up. And in the meantime, be excellent to each other.